Question: have your thighs ever rubbed together, creating a rash because of friction? Chafe is no joke, but thanks to MegaBabe, it's also no problem. Thigh Rescue is the anti-chafe stick made for chafers by chafers. Get MegaBabe's Thigh Rescue and experience what 10,000 five-star reviewers rave about. Thigh Rescue stops chafe. With one sold every 30 seconds, you better run to MegaBabeBeauty.com.
At Highland, we're all about celebrating little wins and little ways to innovate digital processes. There's no customer pain point too small for us to help with. Maybe that's why more than half of the Fortune 100 looks to Highland to connect their content and data, improve processes, and turn little efficiencies into big wins for their customers and clients. Highland, intelligent content solutions for innovators everywhere at highland.com.
Tech Talk with Jess Kelly.
In association with Viatel Technology Group, IT leaders breathe easy with Viatel Managed Cybersecurity. Viatel.com.
This is News Talk.
Yeah, you're very welcome along to Tech Talk. This is Jess Kelly with you here on News Talk. Coming up over the next hour, I'm going to take you inside the International Digital Health Summer School, which took place in Maynooth this week, to hear how our health service could be utterly transformed thanks to technology. As always, you can email the show, techtalk@newstalk.com, or you'll find me on Instagram at JessKellyNT. But on Thursday of this week, I jumped on the train and headed to Maynooth University. The campus was playing host to the International Digital Health Summer School. The agenda featured some of the biggest names in the world of health, technology and data protection. I met with Dr. John Sheehan, consultant radiologist at BlackRock Health and the clinical director of mobile medical diagnostics, as well as Martin Curley, the professor of innovation at Maynooth University, who explained why I was there.
Well, first, thank you, Jess. You've just been on our, you know, proactive, you know, patient panel, and you've actually given a great talk. Well, you're here because you're one of the people. We have built this ecosystem, this community of people that are driving and demanding change in Irish health, to use digital health to transform all of our lives. We've brought people from all over the world, as well as health leaders from Ireland, to Maynooth for 2 days for our International Digital Health Summer School. And we have an agenda that Dr. John Sheehan and I have been driving called Stay Left, Shift Left, 10X. And this is about transforming our healthcare system from one that's predominantly an illness-based to one that's wellness, from one that's primarily operated in the hospital to the home, and where we see a shift in power from doctor knows best to patients know best. And we believe, you know, our Irish health system, we have the most committed, you know, clinicians that are really passionate, but we're really struggling. And we're the absolute laggard in digital technology. We're 27th place out of 27. Around the world, people are acknowledging that digital is the answer, and that we can do a lot better patient experience, better outcomes. We can discover disease earlier and turn it around. So we've been building a movement, and we're going to publish something called the Maynooth Manifesto that is going to ask for this dramatic change. And there's been quite a few interesting announcements, but the most dramatic one: Ireland has had two lost decades of looking for a national electronic health record. We've been able to announce that in collaboration with the HSE, working with the amazing team in HSE Social Inclusion, led by Maxine Ratcliffe, we've been able to announce a living lab that's already operational with 15,000 patients that have really complex needs. And we have an electronic health record for everybody. Sláinte Care and the new digital strategy talks about one patient, one record. That's been delivered. We have real-time communication, so clinicians and patients that are distributed, we can confer in real time and actually recommend actions. And then we also can, you know, securely move files around and store it. So the days of people going to their GP or to their hospital consultant or A&E and having to repeat their entire history will be over if we adopt this solution, because everything is there. The doctor, you know, we have patients, Maxine, she is the director of social inclusion. She has a solution response for vulnerable people. She has records of 300 or 400 encounters in 5, 6, 7 different locations, and it's all integrated, and we can have continuous care and really good care, because all the clinicians can see the history, it can be shared with the patient, and they can work together in real time. So, you know, we've had 2 lost, you know, decades, and we now have a solution, and we just need to decide to scale it out. And the beauty of this solution is actually open source, so it's not commercial. Saying open source doesn't mean it's dodgy or it's cheap. It's certified by the ONC, which is the US Digital Health Agency. It's used by thousands of clinicians in the US, in Israel, and Mexico. So we've now stood up a solution, and led by HSE Social Inclusion, they have done absolutely amazing work, and we now just need to decide to scale it so everybody in Ireland can actually have a personal electronic health record and get the best care possible.
Mm. We're going to hear from Maxine later in the show, but I know from friends and family, from colleagues, people with chronic conditions, it is incredibly frustrating when you go into a hospital, you've given your health history 1,000,001 times, you go to the experts looking for help, and they can't access the information that you've provided 10, 15, maybe even 100 times in some cases. From the clinician's point of view, is this going to be beneficial? Because I'm sure doctors and nurses and those working in our hospitals get frustrated by having to go through the same procedure time and again because of the lack of that centralized record.
Well, we're all in this together, and everybody in this ecosystem, whether you're a patient, a provider, a nurse, a doctor, feels all those different pinch points and pain points and all those speed bumps in the system that really are avoidable. And, you know, kind of what Martin is referring to in terms of this potential for the electronic healthcare record backbone, if I could just say that, you know, the invading of this digital health spine is not just a step, but it's a leap towards a healthier Ireland. It's the backbone of our Stay Left, Shift Left 10X vision. And it weaves together 3 things: prevention, community care, and cutting-edge technology. This isn't just modernizing healthcare, it's revolutionizing how we keep our nation well. It's the digital pulse that will help every heart in Ireland beat stronger.
And I think that's what it's all about, right? It's about keeping, I always quote you, Martin, you're one of the most quoted people on my show and in my career. Things like, you know, keeping well people well for longer, understanding and empowering not patients but citizens to take action and to ask questions about their health. You put me on to the My Life app, which has completely transformed my own health and well-being. This isn't some lofty notions plan. This is, you know, a vision that is changing people's lives today and will keep people in this country safer, better, well, for much longer in their lives.
Yeah, it's really exciting, Jess, and you actually gave a great testimonial of your own story using the My Life app, which is available for free. But one of our other colleagues, John Shaw of Carillon, he talks a lot about, you know, people look back in 2024, how is it that people knew a lot more about the health of their cars than they did about their own? We're at this threshold moment, and 2-3 really exciting things. The first is this announcement yesterday of an open source electronic health record that can be scaled for everybody in the country at a fraction of the 2 or 3 billion that the government are budgeting. So we actually have a work. This isn't a strategy, because it's absolutely real. We just actually need to scale it out, and we've assembled with the HSE Social Inclusion team. We have a set of partners that are ready to start scaling this. And actually, as John said yesterday in the conference, we actually need to demand this service. It actually is a right. Everybody needs to have this information. So that's the most exciting thing. But in parallel with that, there are all sorts of devices which we're demonstrating today. With Peter Sogard from Aarhus University, Aalborg University in Denmark, and he's showcasing a new AI tool for calculating something called VO2 max. And this is the best indicator actually of a person's health, and it turns out to be the best predictor of your longevity. So what Peter is showing his device, in 40 seconds we can now measure your VO2 health, our VO2 score, compared to what used to have to happen. You used to have to go to a lab and you know, get on a treadmill or a bike for 20 minutes and you needed to have a mask. Mm. Took a half an hour, a lot of effort. Now you can do that in 40 seconds and you can have your score, and there are things you can do to improve your VO2 max score, and that will help you live longer. We're demonstrating other technologies like AI analysis of ECGs. So an ECG, if you can do that, you can avoid an echo test. In some places, there's an 18-month waiting list for echo tests in Ireland. But now, actually, a lot of people on that waiting list may actually not need it, and we can do that screening with it. But there are some people that really need it, mm-hmm. and some people die while they're waiting on the waiting list. So all of these tools, and we're, you know, using this very simple strategy, stay left, shift left, 10x, to direct these and make sure that they complement. So, and the third point is just the patient empowerment. We need to give, you know, the patient isn't passive, and we actually need to get rid of the word patient. As we discussed in the panel, it's about the person, and it's about proactive and preventative. There is so much. You're going to talk to Gary Boyle, who's a Parkinson advocate. He's just completed a marathon, and he talks about taking responsibility for his own health, and there's so many things he has done to actually improve his health, you know, in collaboration with his consultant. So I think this new electronic health record and health system, the new technologies, and this shift of power to the patients. Now, you still work, it's about self-care and shared care, but if we can get the three of those things working, and we have them now, it can be transformative for everybody's individual health, mm-hmm. and it can make our system the best one in Europe.
But I want to pick up on one point, and that is around patient empowerment, which is absolutely there and it's fantastic. But I know of people who are on waiting lists. They don't have private healthcare insurance. They do have chronic conditions, and they're being told by medical professionals to go and spend £500 on an Apple Watch because it can give them data that there's a waiting list to get monitors for in hospitals. When is that going, like, is that going to shift, that the customer is being penalized financially because they have to go out and buy medical devices because the waiting lists are so bananas?
Well, actually, this comes down, I'll let John jump in here because he's the clinician, he is on the front line, but there's a bigger question around the business model in healthcare right now. Michael Porter, who's a famous Harvard professor, he talks about the business model in healthcare. He says too many people get paid more to do the wrong thing. So as part of this, we have to completely change the business model. In the past, Chinese doctors got paid to keep people well, and if you were well, you paid. But if you got sick, you didn't pay. So we need that transformational model. And the great thing about digital is it is democratizing. It's democratizing information. It's democratizing access to services. And all of these diagnostics are becoming cheaper, but we absolutely do need, there's something called the inverse care law, which says actually the people that most need the care have the least access to it. And we need to change that. A piece of it is changing the business model, but a piece of it, digital is going to break down those walls, and technologies that previously were only available to people that had insurance will hopefully become mainstream. So I think that's the hope. It's going to take some time. John, what do you think?
I think, like everything in life, you've got to motivate and incentivize all the various different stakeholders, whether it's the patient, the physicians, and the healthcare providers, be it public or private. I think everybody wants the same goal, but it's important that people see an opportunity to really, what we need to now focus on is value-based care and outcome care rather than a transactional approach to care. And we need, as Martin would have said, you know, all these Copernican shifts of going from doctor knows best to patient knows best, going from physical to virtual, and going from treatment to prevention. But, you know, an interesting thing, Dr. Michael Zuck, who's the current new chair of the American Medical Association, he's also the chief physician officer of the Geisinger Healthcare in the US. And what they're now actually doing is, for patients, for example, who are going for a hip replacement, a bit like going and buying yourself a car that's got a warranty for 10 years, if you now get your hip replaced in certain places in the States, you've got a warranty for that hip. So if it goes great, everybody's happy. If there's a complication and you need a wound infection managed, or indeed a revision, that's completely covered. So again, everybody's incentivized and motivated to do their best.
Mm. awesome stuff. Well, look, we're going to continue this conversation throughout the show. I'd love to hear your experience. You can get in touch, techtalk@newstalk.com. But for the moment, thank you both so much.
Thank you, Jess.
Thank you.
Richard White-Haynes, Director of HCI, Health and Care Innovations, based in the UK.
So we've just heard from Martin and John about some of the conversations that have been taking place this week. There's an awful lot going on, and that has been going on, in terms of digital health over the last number of years. Do you think patients or those who need to interact with the health service at large are understanding and engaging with the technology, or are they fearful of it for, you know, data protection reasons, privacy reasons, and all that side of things?
No, actually, I'll take a contra view. I think patients really want to engage with the technical tools that are available to them. The bigger challenge we see is actually in the healthcare professional community and their willingness to recommend it, their willingness to engage with it, and put very simply, change their way of thinking so that they prescribe a digital health solution in the same way as they might just prescribe a drug. It's not as the system doesn't make it easy, but culturally and in mindset wise, they are presenting a barrier themselves, and it's a really weird thing. I always talk about sort of number 18 bus syndrome. So I hear so often, oh, my patients won't want this, my patients won't want. But they don't know that, and they make this assumption. But then when that member of staff finishes their shift, gets on the number 18 bus home, the first thing they do is get their phone out and start dealing with the world digitally. So I struggle with why they decide for themselves that no, it's not for their patients. Yeah. And the really sad thing is that healthcare professionals have such power. Their recommendation, their engagement, their asking the patient to participate in other means, mm-hmm. has such power in terms of engaging a patient and getting them to get them on board. Yeah. So that would be my take on it. Completely yeah. different to the question maybe you asked, but
yeah, but it's great to hear that that's your take, because I would completely agree. I think. I don't know if it's a hangover from the early days of Google. I know my GP would always give out to me going, stop going to Dr. Google first, come to me. And I understand and appreciate that. But when we're in the era of devices that can give you an ECG reading, perhaps when you're having a tachycardic event and you can capture it, and then you go to the GP, as we heard from Doreen on the panel earlier on, she couldn't, even whilst doing a stress test, she couldn't recreate it. And so it's very difficult for the clinicians then to understand. Whereas now, because of her cardio device, apps on her phone, she can bring evidence. So surely that should be welcomed by the healthcare professionals, to have digital evidence, physical evidence that is there, that is showcasing what's going on with patients when they are outside the doors of an emergency room.
Yeah, and what's really weird in there, Jess, is that you've got a circumstance where those barriers are raised. Mm-hmm. Like they say, oh no, it's not on a, unless it's an MRI from a device in there, hospital, they don't rely on it. Mm. But patients turn up every day trying to remember what's happened to them over the last 6 months, 8 months, a year. Why is that more reliable than a series of data that they've collected on their watch, that they may have recorded on an app? Why are those stories, those experiences, those facts not worth much more than an MRI that may have happened 6 months ago, or a blood test that's out of date? Mm-hmm. And the trouble is, we're only dealing with very wide data points, whereas the stuff you collect on your watch mm-hmm. every day, and what they collect on our app every day, is a story. It's a rich story. It's happening daily, and it's in the moment. It's from the home. And I think that's about that shift that I talked about in my talk, was mm-hmm. clinicians have to understand in the future that the patient is going to come in with as much knowledge about their disease, not just their lived experience, but a record mm-hmm. of their disease. And they'll be looking at it going, oh, I can see what's happening. I can see how it's changing, or I can see that if I change my diet, this has an impact on my, mm-hmm. you know, it might be my heart rate, might be my sleeping. It might be on my pain when I've got rheumatoid arthritis. They come in with that knowledge, and somehow healthcare professionals are going to have to shift their mindset, their way of thinking, so that in the future they understand their role is as a facilitator of knowledge from all sorts of places alongside their patient. That's, you could argue, a bigger shift than the technology shift is that cultural mindset shift.
I'm sure this is very frustrating for people who have chronic conditions and are in and out of hospitals on an ongoing basis, because they are wondering, when is this going to happen? Maybe they can't afford for it to take 5 or 10 years. Yeah. So how do we speed it up, and how do we get the buy-in so it's not done through gritted teeth?
That is a $64,000 question. If I could solve it, my business would grow massively, I suppose. It's really weird, isn't it? I made a note for myself yesterday in the discussions. If we had a drug that could save 100,000 lives a year and the health system didn't implement it, there'd be uproar. Mm-hmm. Yet somehow, at this conference, we've got tools that could save 100,000 lives a year and more, every year. And yet somehow it's so hard to get it implemented. So many entrenched views, so many, I think, narrow mindsets, so much, sadly, so much pressure on clinicians already that they've hardly got space to stop and think about what is available and out there, let alone the space to deliver on it. Mm. And somehow we have to create this space, in all sense, we have to create the space that people can really start delivering at this stuff at pace and sustainably, repeatedly. And it's tough. It's lots of incremental steps, keep going and going and going at it. It's also going to need massive leadership skills, I think, at every level of the system, so that people have clarity about what we're trying to achieve. You know, if I walk on the ward now and say, your ward's going to be digital in 5 years, what do you think that looks like? I put money on it. Almost every nurse, every healthcare assistant, every doctor would struggle to describe that picture. But unless they've got a picture in their head, that clarity, it ain't going to happen. Mm. Then they've got to get them, we've got to get these healthcare professionals and the teams, the performance teams, the transformation teams, capable of delivering this stuff and giving them the skills to do it. And then finally, we've got to win their commitment, their desire to make it happen. But wow, so that clarity, capability and commitment is a real challenge, but that's what's got to happen.
My final question, it's probably not a cheery one, but should we look at our health service as a pandemic? Because when COVID happened, everybody adapted overnight. Everybody who worked in jobs had to work remotely. Some people worked from their ironing board with a backdrop of their fridge and they just got on with it. Yeah. We found the power and the capability and the sign off for the COVID tracker app. Digital vaccination certificates became a reality. We just did it because it was an emergency and there were lives at risk. Surely we should take that approach to the health service and say, okay, COVID is not here as prevalent as it was, but there's all these other things. Yeah. We need to respond as if it was an emergency on a global scale and just get the thing done.
Yeah, yes, and that's, we come back to that's that issue about leadership, I think, about saying, I can see what we've got to do here and I'm going to stop just talking about it and we're going to make it happen. Because that's what happened during the pandemic. We just made stuff happen. And we can talk about this forever. And as far as I can see, we are doing a lot of talking about it. But the scale of the opportunity, the leap that has to be made, just for the protection of all those patients and families out there, is so massive that just the incremental model of lead in terms of leadership thinking is insufficient any longer, and we have to make that leap.
Yeah, that was Richard Wyatt-Haynes speaking to me at the International Digital Health Summer School. As I mentioned earlier in the programme, I would love to hear your thoughts and your experiences. You can drop me an email to techtalk@newstalk.com. But when we come back here on News Talk, I'm going to introduce you to the woman who has worked tirelessly on the creation and the expansion of that digital spine that Martin Curley mentioned earlier. It's the Electronic Health Record System. Stay tuned.
Tech Talk with Jess Kelly.
Welcome back to Tech Talk. This is Jess Kelly with you here on News Talk. I'm bringing you inside the International Digital Health Summer School. It took place in Maynooth earlier in the week, and one of the biggest announcements from that event was the unveiling of a fully functional platform for electronic health records. I don't think I can overstate the potential impact of this. It will utterly transform our health service. I spoke to the woman who's led this project.
So my name is Maxine Radcliffe and I am the Service Director for the Response for Vulnerable People's teams based in South Dublin, Kildare and West Wicklow. Response for Vulnerable People, a series of teams. We work with migrants, homeless people, Roma and other excluded groups. So that's all the people in direct provision, homeless people who are rough sleeping and a whole range of other people. I'm a nurse. I'm also a stage two PhD scholar in, stage two PhD scholar in University College Dublin, where I'm looking at women's experiences of homelessness.
Martin Curley mentioned you earlier in the show about the work that you have done on this digital spine, as it's being called, the electronic health records. We were talking about it on The Hard Shoulder on Wednesday, and the consensus we got from our listeners was that this is transformational. They want it yesterday, particularly those with chronic health conditions where they're carrying around binders and binders and binders, people who've gone into hospitals and found their records missing or not up to date or no longer relevant. Tell me how exactly it works from a patient point of view and then from a hospital point of view, if you don't mind.
So right now we've had this operational since 2019. We started very small scale, just for the complex homeless clients that I would have worked with. So I came in as a homeless complex case manager, came into an office full of paper records, came from an entirely digital system. And paper records are very limited. You can only see them when you're physically with them. You can't search them. If you spill a cup of coffee on it, it's gone. You know, so we moved to a system that's open source, so all of the things that we build and we develop are also available to everyone else, which is very exciting. We did that in 2019 for our homeless clients. So for me as a clinician, I can log on to this system anywhere I'm on the HSE network. So that's any hospital, my phone, anywhere. It's system agnostic, so it's not tied to being an Apple phone or a Google this or whatever. It's you just go in through the web browser, there you go. I can look somebody up, I can see their records, I can scan notes, letters into it, I can code. And actually when we started in 2019, I had to go back to my old colleagues in the NHS and get the digital code sets, NOMAD codes, because we didn't have that library in Ireland yet. So we were the first system in Ireland to have that in the community. And it's a game changer because it means I can be anywhere. So I can literally be in the street meeting someone for the first time who's maybe, you know, a homeless rough sleeper with complex needs. And if I've met them before, if they've got a history, we can look it up. It just gives us real-time access to health information for people themselves. So what we're... That's just the homeless population. During COVID, we expanded that enormously, and we started using all kinds of video technologies to enable us to do video consultation and remote consultations with our clients. I was able to be supported by nurses around the country. So I would have had nurses sat in Mullingar, nurses sat in Longford, nurses sat in Drogheda. We were all able to support a group of patients in Dublin because we all had access to an electronic health record and the video technology and as part of that. So it's a game changer in terms of the way you consult people, in terms of the information recorded. So you've got safe information, safe consultation modes. Information doesn't get lost and it's very readily accessible. So it's really quick. For the patients themselves, I suppose to tell you a story about a particular patient, and this again is someone who we've worked with since 2019, it's quite transformational. So lots of people we work with have really difficult times in life. They're homeless, they don't have anything. One particular person we worked with who had a series of brain injuries, so they bounced in and around many, many Dublin hospitals. And as part of this, they kept losing everything. So they kept losing all their ID, losing all their records. We had scanned everything. So We knew their PPS number. They couldn't remember their PPS number. We had their ID, you know, so it's for them, it's transformational. What we are going to do is we are bringing in, and we hope to have it live by the end of September, a portal. So lots of you, I know that you talk about another app in your show, but we will be able to enable the patients to see their records themselves. So that already exists. It's a functionality that we haven't enabled yet for reasons I won't go into now, but it means that they'll be able to send us documents or answer questionnaires. So for example, if we're asking someone to come in and see us and they've maybe got a major issue with alcohol and they're coming to have a consultation about that, they can give us an update ahead of time. Or diabetes would be another example. There's lots of ways in which you'd want to be able to interact with your healthcare provider and tell them information before you come and sit in a room with them, mm-hmm. whether that's physically or virtually. Mm-hmm. So it's already operating.
Yeah. It's incredible to hear that this is operational right now, because I know there are people, again, friends and family, who have chronic health conditions. They are wearing wearables. They know what their heart rate is. They know if they've had an instance of, whether it was a tachycardic instance or whether their blood sugar dipped, you know, dramatically out of nowhere. It's all stored in the phone. And I know anecdotally that they spend the first 20 minutes of their GP appointment or their hospital consultation regurgitating information, rather than, you know, just the doctor being able to dip in straight away, tap on a screen and get all that information. That's going to enhance, surely, the efficiencies of our health service as a whole, just in terms of time alone, regardless of anything else.
Of course.
That is good news for the bottom line.
There's no doubt about that. So the portal app that we're going to roll out will pull all that information. Some of it, I can't tell you now, it's going to work with every single wearable on the market, but the patients that we have will be able to put stuff into that. And we have 15,000 patients in our three different EHR units, and they're some of the most marginalized people. So it's available to all the people that go through at the moment. I don't know how much to talk about this actually, but it is the record that is used in the National Transit Centre, because I set up the National Transit Centre Health Service in March 2022, and it was very clear to me immediately I needed to be able to record what was happening. I had people coming into me with records in Russian that we had to get translated and scanned, and you know, and those people have been moved all around the country. Anyway, so for those patients, to get back to what you were asking about, for them to be able to put that information in their own app and see their own record and show, here's the medicine I'm on, here's what my doctor says, here's the scan I had, and it's verified. That's going to be very, very powerful. So we already have that. They already have a record. The portal front end of it will be going live in September for the people that are already part of this. We are hoping that we will be allowed to scale it out to the wider HSE. And I say we are hoping we will be allowed to do that, because this is about political will. We're not talking about a huge cost here. Because this is open source software, it is built for free. So the software itself is free. Any developments and enhancements we make will be used by people around the world. And it's very secure.
Okay, so are we optimistic that is going to happen?
I'm hopeful. So I met the chief medical officer this morning and I demoed the system to him, and he was very excited by it, is my understanding, and I believe we'll be having other high level conversations. So I'm quite hopeful, because we're not talking about it requiring lots of nuts and bolts to deliver. This is the equivalent of, say, using Amazon on your phone or something. So we just have to turn up a dial to make it bigger. There will of course be some bits that we need to figure out if we're scaling from 15,000 to 5 million, but there's nothing to stop us doing that. My ambition, my hope, is that every single person in Ireland has this in their pocket in 2 years' time. And I'm sitting here as a blow-in from England. But this is important to me. You know, my children are Irish. I live here. I want things to work better for people here. And we have a golden opportunity to enormously leapfrog over what's been done in the NHS, where there's lots of issues with different bits being segmented from one another. You know, we could be the digital health leaders in 2026.
Yeah, that was Maxine Radcliffe explaining the electronic health record system. I really hope this happens because it has the potential to change everything. Doesn't matter if you are someone with a chronic condition or you are young, fit and healthy, this will change everything. I would love to know your experiences if you're someone who's interacted with the health service a lot. Perhaps you've been somebody impacted by whether it's missing records, missed appointments, no follow-ups. Drop me an email, please, to techtalk@newstalk.com. This is something that we're very much going to stay on top of and hopefully follow it as it comes to fruition. But when we come back here on News Talk, we'll meet Gary Boyle, who is living with Parkinson's, and he's going to tell me how technology has helped him and others living with the illness.
Tech Talk with Jess Kelly.
Welcome back to the final part of this week's Tech Talk. This is Jess Kelly with you here on News Talk. I'm going to bring you back to the International Digital Health Summer School. So far, we've spoken about the technology and the clinical side, but I now want to bring you the story of a man who is living with Parkinson's.
My name is Gary Boyle, and I'm a person living with Parkinson's disease, and I'm also Vice President of Parkinson's Europe.
Can you just tell me a little bit about your diagnosis, when it happened, what your reaction was, and how you processed it?
Well, for a couple of years before I was actually diagnosed, I noticed a few things were starting to go amiss with my function, my body. I'd be brushing my teeth, my toothbrush would stop moving and my hand would stop moving. I didn't know why. Or when I was walking, my arm didn't swing like that. And I went to numerous kind of movement people and physiotherapists and stuff like that, but got nowhere until one morning I walked into a consultant's rooms. And he kind of took one look at me and he said, yeah, you have young onset Parkinson's disease, but don't worry, it won't kill you. And my response to him was, I'm 44, I'm not 74. How could I possibly have such a thing? And he followed that up by saying, well, he had somebody in here yesterday. She's 29. She has it too, you know. So that was kind of a massive blow. I went home, told my wife. We just didn't know what to do. We cried our eyes out. We kind of thought, you know, what's going to happen now? And I really felt, you know, my career was over, and I thought like we'd probably never move, you know, or anything like that. So it was a massive shock, and it took me a long time to come to terms with it. It took me about 5 years to come to terms with it, by which point I was really shaking a lot. I was taking medication, but it wasn't very effective. My quality of life was very poor because I was really, you know, at work I was really conscious of it, even though not everybody was probably, but after a few years people would have started to notice it, all right. And it's hard to kind of keep that hidden and kind of carry on with a normal, very busy, heavy day. I tried that for as long as I could, but eventually it caught up with me.
How, like, dealing with the diagnosis is one thing, but with something like Parkinson's that does evolve over time and become more debilitating over time, did the mental load of that prognosis weigh as heavily as the initial diagnosis?
It kind of did, because, I mean, it was exactly that I was afraid of. You know, I was thinking, this thing has no cure. Mm-hmm. I knew that anyway. I had kind of some kind of experience of Parkinson's before. My mother's sister, my aunt, she had been diagnosed with Parkinson's, and she, you know, she really change in front of me, you know. I was very young when she was diagnosed, and I could kind of see her kind of changing, and that's kind of jumped into my head like 20 years later. But I just had to find some way to deal with it, because I was not going to be any good to anybody, my wife or my kids or anything like that. I'd be no good to them and no good to anybody at work or anything like that if something, you know, didn't change.
Yeah. And so what did change, and how did you shift your outlook and begin to live a life rather than just accept a diagnosis?
Yeah, I mean, the big change was when my consultant said to me, Gary, you're suffering from stress. And I said, really? Who doesn't suffer from stress, you know? Yeah, but in your case, Gary, it's the stress level you're at is kind of affecting your dopamine production, and you know, it's your dopamine cells are being chewed up, and you've lost about 40% already, and you don't know. And that's actually true for most people who are kind of diagnosed with Parkinson's, because the effects, the symptoms are now being, you know, experienced regularly, and they're very evident and all that kind of stuff. It means you have a lot, you've really a deficit, and it's time to, you know, arrest that deficit as much as possible. And it's not very possible to do it, but that's why early detection would be really a wonderful breakthrough. But for me, it was a case of I have to stop, because I can't continue like this. So I was that was his, you know, decision. I was fortunately, the company I work for have an income protection program for people who are go out on long-term illness or catastrophic injury or something like that. And that was there, but you had to go through the, you know, a lot of rules and all that kind of stuff to kind of meet the criteria, which I did. And I remember the day, like when that came, when I got word, like when the doctor said to me, she had done a lot of tests on me to make sure I wasn't kind of faking it, you know. And I said to her, why would I fake it? And she said, well, most people coming in that door are faking it, you know. So, I mean, I thought, right, okay. But I couldn't do what she asked me to, you know, walk a straight line and stuff like that, or kind of, you know, lift your hands up, or whatever it was that she was. So she kind of was skeptical at the start, but within about 10 minutes, she kind of went, this guy is serious, you know, because I was doing everything she was asking me to do as best I could. But that was very important. That gave me the breakthrough I needed, even though I didn't think I needed it, but I really did need it, because I needed to stop what I was doing. It was killing me, and I needed to find some other way of living. And as I mentioned before, my brother Patrick lives around the corner from me, and we had been running anyway, but we just stepped that up a bit, and it was incredible. And I was also put on Cinemet, which is a dopamine, L-Dopa, and it's really kind of the Rolls Royce of drugs for this neurological condition. And between that and the exercise, I suddenly started to kind of sleep better and kind of eat better and be better, you know. I mean, I was better, but I wasn't cured. But I mean, it's a good thing to be. It's a good place to be in when you've been used to everything going wrong. Yeah. You know? Now, that was great. It really did, you know, get better. Mm-hmm. And so I had to. I was feeling better, and I then realised that, you know, exercise is something that's really important. Mm-hmm. And I realised that, you know, getting good night's sleep is really important, and all the things that your mummy told you when you were growing up, you know, these are really important. These are basic things. And so I did all those basic things, and things started to work out much better. Mm-hmm. One of the most important things I did was a speech and language therapy, very intensive course called LSVT Loud. And that really gave me, you know, the tools to deal with my voice fading, because my voice was fading. My wife is a speech and language therapist. She was able to tell me that. But I did these exercises. I do these exercises all the time, and I can keep my voice, you know, strong. And hopefully it'll come out strong enough when you're recording and stuff like that. But that's been really important to me, to kind of keep sane and keep on an even keel. And I really kind of, you know, feel bad for a lot of people who are not doing exercise, or who are not, you know, taking care of themselves that way, because they don't know, which is shocking in this day and age. I mean, we have so much information. We have so many ways we can help people with neurological conditions, but they not everybody knows, because they don't. They're, for whatever reason, their medical doctor doesn't engage with them. You know, they just kind of turn up for an annual assessment, and, you know, they're just tracking kind of a losing situation. Yeah. Whereas I've been very fortunate that I know I'm deteriorating at probably a faster pace than I would like, but I'm definitely like 15 years into a diagnosis, and I'm, you know, I'm pleased with the way things have gone so far. I mean, unless of course you tell me I'm cured. I mean, that would be fantastic. But
you did a marathon.
Yeah, I did. Yeah, that was the culmination of my two brothers came with me on that, and that was just great fun, you know. But we were definitely practicing for it for a long time, and I felt great afterwards. I mean, you know, dopamine release is really, really good. But I mean, if I can do it, other people can do it. Mm-hmm. And that's what I really kind of feel so agitated about, that people aren't getting the information they need. Mm-hmm. That they can decide themselves what they want to do with the information, but, you know, being told simple things like, you know, take more exercise, it's a bit of a cliche, and that's why it's probably not taken seriously. Mm-hmm. But it is really, really good. Mm-hmm. I mean, any form of exercise, swimming, cycling, running, you know, it's really good. And I remember when I met up with, you know, 10 of my buddies, and we did the charity cycle around Iceland 5 years ago. I can't believe it's 5 years already, but I mean, it's just amazing to do that.
Yeah.
And again, lots of people, it's not just me doing it, lots of people can do these kind of things, and they can, you know, engage in ways that they wouldn't have thought possible. Mm-hmm. And it is possible. Mm-hmm. And it's really, you know, I mean, consider this, like, I know people in their early 60s who are now in homes where they're kind of looked after because they haven't been able to look after themselves for whatever reason. I think that is just wrong. Mm. You know, nobody getting a diagnosis of Parkinson's, young or old, should be staring down the kind of the end of time kind of thing. It doesn't have to be that way. Mm. We can educate people, we can, I'll advocate for them forever, but I mean, We need to get information to people's hands so they can deal with it and do what they need to do. We need to get communication devices into everybody's hands up and down the country, because we don't know how many people in Ireland are living with this condition. We think it's somewhere between 12 and 18,000, which is a huge kind of spread. But we need people to have, you know, people who are living on their own, or people who are just the mum and dad and kids have flown the coop kind of stuff. They need to be in touch with whoever. And we have the technology to do it.
Yep.
We had a situation where one of the big interventions that's a very effective therapy for Parkinson's is actually Irish set dancing, mm-hmm. which is crazy. I mean, I would never do Irish set dancing in my wildest dreams, you know. But it does give you, it really helped me get my gait, my balance, my walk, get them all much better, mm-hmm. and really natural now. And I can do that. Mm-hmm. But lots of other people can do that too.
They can, but I think you're right. I think it does come back to information sharing.
Absolutely.
Hearing from people like yourself. If people want to know more, like, where is a good place? If somebody in a family member or a person themselves has recently been diagnosed, yeah. or perhaps is living with a diagnosis but hasn't made the change that you made 5 years in, where is a good point to start?
Well, there are three Parkinson's charities in Ireland. There's Early Onset PD, eopd.ie. There is Move for Parkinson's, and there is the Parkinson's Ireland. That's probably the biggest one, and they have branches all over the country.
It has been a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, that was Gary Boyle. If you want more information, there's a whole host of websites that Gary mentioned there. But if you want to get a pen and paper, it's just parkinsons.ie, and that is a good place to get started. But that's it from me this week. If you missed any of this week's show, you can listen back in full on the News Talk app powered by Go Loud. I would love to hear your experiences of the health service, be they good, bad, whatever. Drop me an email, please. techtalk@newstalk.com.
What does innovation sound like? It sounds like the luxury of being in the moment with your customer, client, or patient. It sounds like having the right information right when you need it. It sounds like being at your best for your customers and your business. Thanks to Hyland's intelligent content solutions that improve digital processes, innovators everywhere are able to do their thing better, whatever that thing is. Now, who doesn't like the sound of that? Hyland, for innovators everywhere, visit hyland.com.